my guest on Podcasting Them Softly is very talented filmmaker Sean Schaal. He is the director of the wonderful new documentary on a personal favourite of mine, Ooabowl. It is called Fuck You All. And I mean that in the nicest possible way. Ooabowl. Enough said. If you don't know who Ooabowl is, then, well, maybe you shouldn't be listening to us. But Sean has made a wonderful, wonderful portrait of the filmmaker now, having since retired from the profession. He's now a restaurateur. I was kind of sad. I was trying like hell to get into the business so I could possibly work with Ooabowl, but he's gone now, so I'll never get that great honor, unfortunately. But I do have the honor of speaking with his biographer of sorts today, Sean. Thank you for being on Podcast Them Softly.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
So, Sean, before we get into the film, I guess just to keep your audience informed, and I was wondering if you could give us a little bit of a brief bio of your history of filmmaking prior to coming to the making of Fuck You All.
Yeah, no problem. I've been making documentaries for 10 years now. This is my fifth film. And yeah, I've kind of always done it myself independently outside of the studio system, much like Ooabowl. And he presents himself as a great documentary subject. He was a great guy to work with.
That's fantastic. So I suppose how did you collide, if one, or how did you come to meet Dr. Boll and obviously form a relationship with him prior to filming the documentary?
Well, I actually worked on one of his films called Assault on Wall Street,
right,
which would have been maybe 2010, just as a crew member, and got a chance to see him work, you know, in person, and it was incredible. He works like no other director, really doesn't follow any of the rules.
Right.
And I was so fascinated by him. And then, you know, cut to years later, a TV show that I was working on was shooting in his restaurant.
Right.
And it was right around the time that I was looking for a new documentary subject, and it just kind of made sense. I was chatting with a coworker about what a crazy story Uwe had. And as I was explaining the story to my coworker, at the same time I was thinking to myself, this is probably my next documentary.
Sure.
And shot Uwe an email, and he was nice enough to meet with me, and we hit it off pretty well immediately, and next thing you know, we were shooting.
Is it easier for him to talk about it all now that he is, for all intents and purposes, outside of the profession?
Well, he never really bit his tongue while he was doing it either, which was, you know, a problem for him, and also what got him a lot of press.
Right, but I mean, so, I mean in terms of reflecting now.
Yeah, he definitely he's very self-aware of everything.
Right.
So he definitely can look back with you know, not through rose-colored glasses. He's very aware of where he was in Hollywood and what he accomplished.
Right. You rounded up a very nice collection of cohorts that have worked with him. Among them, actors like Michael Paré, Eddie and the Cruisers, people. Who doesn't remember Eddie and the Cruisers? Clint Howard. Of course, he's been in everything, not just his brother's movies. Wonderful to see Keith David. Keith David. I've always wanted to have a chat with Keith David. Keith David, is he as cool as I think he might be?
Yeah, he's really cool. I'm a huge fan of The Thing, so
right,
I was,
right,
like, nerding out myself about, you know, getting to meet Childs from The Thing.
Right.
And he was super nice. Great dude. Came out, did a really non-rushed interview, and had a lot of really nice things to say about Uwe. Loved working with him.
Mm. He did. He seemed...
Yeah, it was such a...
Yeah, go on, sorry.
I'm sorry?
Yeah. No, I said he seems...
I was going to say, it's kind of a strange partnership to see Keith David and Ooabowl work on the same project.
That's right. But what I was going to say was his comments have a lot of gravity to them, do you think? Like, he's very you know, he strikes me as a man who thinks long and hard about his response before delivering it, and his responses seem to carry the most weight, as simple as they are. Like his when he speaks, it's very arresting in the film.
Yeah, and he spent a lot of time in the industry, so he really, you know, has a point of reference and really understands Uwe's impact, you know, good or bad on the film industry and his, you know, accomplishments.
Mm.
So he was, he was a good guy to talk to because he's worked with, you know, giant directors. He's worked on smaller things. You know, Keith had a pretty wide career.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, he definitely runs the gamut. I would love to have sat down with him, like you said, to talk about The Thing and They Live and, of course, Platoon. And certainly a favorite of mine of his is Men at Work. There are many things secret in this world. One of them happens to be another man's prize.
He was a great guy and really made a lot of time for us.
Fantastic. And of course, and of course, Clint Howard is great. Clint's a real workhorse in the film industry. And does just about everything, and he was very candid. I particularly like the story about Uwe reading his magazine, directing while he was reading the magazine.
Clint and Uwe have known each other for 20, 30 years, and have worked together on a ton of projects, and Clint has done, I think if you look at Clint's IMDb, he may have done 200, 250 films.
Yeah.
And he said that Uwe Boll is his favorite director to work with. Like him and Uwe just get along.
Yeah.
He said he'd work for scale on any Uwe movie just because he likes being around him, likes the way he works.
Yeah.
And I think it's refreshing for people that have been in the industry for a long time to work with a director who doesn't follow any of those rules and kind of does it his own way and makes it really comfortable for his actors.
Mm, totally. I guess a good question would be, what was your first Uwe Boll experience, aside from working on the film which you've told us about already? What was your first encounter as far as watching his films, or was that how you first tapped into it? Obviously watching his movies or being in a place where he made a lot of films, was that the way in?
Well, I'd known his reputation before I worked on that film.
Right.
You know, you hear all the stories. And that was my first real face-to-face encounter with him, was watching him work.
Right.
But I didn't see an Uwe Boll film until I watched Postal after working with him on that show.
Okay.
And I couldn't believe it. The first time I saw Postal, I was, you know, shocked. It's such an offensive movie.
Right.
And I couldn't believe that a movie like that could be made.
Mm.
And, you know, it wasn't until years later when I watched the second time that I kind of got what he was trying to do with it.
Right. But
I didn't have a large exposure to Uwe's films before this documentary. Like, before I had started filming, I think I'd seen Postal, Blood Rain, House of the Dead, and maybe one other one.
Right.
So it was, you know, I really dove in when I started doing this film and watching all his previous movies.
Right.
And it's such a crazy body of work.
It is.
You know, whether you like his films or not, to make 32 films on your own terms is quite an accomplishment.
Yeah, totally, totally. Now, well, I'm always coming to it from a fan's perspective. But, of course, I've watched all of his movies and tried relentlessly to get a hold of him. But he was sort of setting up to retire. And I did manage to get him for 15 minutes. He said, "I'm waiting for a car, and I will talk to you until the car comes." And so, so we managed to get a few questions out of him. Unfortunately, the recording was no good, so I couldn't use the recording, so I had to transcribe out of the conversation. But, yes, another person that you spoke to was Guinevere Turner, who I tried for a long time to get a hold of and talk to her about her experience. But you managed to do it. And she was quite candid about the Blood Rain experience. One person that you didn't get that I thought you might have, I was expecting maybe to turn up. Did you ever speak to Doug Taylor? Who wrote...
No, I actually don't.
Who wrote In the Name of the King?
No.
Yeah.
No, I actually don't know his story.
Yeah. No, yeah. Well, Doug's probably more well-known because he wrote Splice with Vincenzo Natali. But when I was looking through his credits, I noticed, shit, In the Name of the King. And, I, of course, I couldn't have an in-depth conversation with Dr. Boll himself, so I contacted Doug and got Doug to give me the inside scoop on what it was like to work on an Uwe Boll film, from the screenwriter's perspective. And he had some wonderful stories. I'll send you a link.
Yeah, I wouldn't want to be a writer working on an Uwe Boll movie.
Yeah, he's got a great I won't spoil it for you. He's got a great story about ninjas. that I'll send you a link and you can have a listen, because it's better from Doug than from me. But
yeah, I'd love to hear.
Yeah, but he's got a great story about a rewrite. He was on set for quite a while and was getting sick of it because I don't know if it was your encounter or your experience through talking with these people and Uwe Boll himself, but apparently he was very susceptible to letting actors change the lines and the dialogue. And so
it seems like the entire writing process is second to the filmmaking part.
Right.
Like he doesn't, unless he wrote it himself, he doesn't really care about the writing.
Right.
It's just, he needs a script to get the people on set and to start shooting.
Right.
So I can't imagine, working on rewrites or having any sort of writing job on a project that's his that he's developing. You know what I mean? It would be tough to get notes.
Yeah. Well, as you'll hear, Doug was actually on set for quite a while and was becoming annoyed at the fact that Burt Reynolds and John Rhys-Davies would keep coming to him with new speeches that they want added. And, of course, he would go to Uwe and say, is this okay? He says, yeah, just give them whatever they want. Don't worry about it. And and so he got quite annoyed after some time doing that, so he left and he went back to Toronto, I think he's from, Doug, and he'd just gotten home, and then when he got a phone call from the production company, said they needed to rewrite a scene because they had paid all this money for this Hong Kong action choreographer for the film, and up until that point he really didn't have anything to do, and so he did write a scene where basically they had what Doug would write as the King's Guard, and the King's Guard were going to be trained a different way, and they were a specialist fighting force, and so they could employ some of this martial arts that they had paid a lot of money for this guy to come and do some martial arts choreography. But I won't spoil it anymore. It's got to do with ninjas. It descends into ninja.
I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, but anyway, getting back to fuck you all. Well, that's gonna be, how's that gonna be like introducing that at a festival? Like fuck you all. And now,
yeah, it's funny how comfortable I've gotten saying fuck you all to people. It really rolls off my tongue now.
I know it's.
It was a no-brainer to name it that. It sums up his entire outlook on things.
Yeah.
It's obviously a nod to his YouTube retirement video of the same title.
Right.
And And we knew that it was going to close a few doors for us, but we also thought it would grab the attention of enough people to make it worth it.
Right. Did you ever see Dan Lee West's documentary from a few years back now, Raging Bull?
Yeah, I did.
Yeah.
I thought it was pretty well made, and we knew that, you know, with his documentary focusing on his battle with the critics and ending with the boxing match, I just felt like there was more story to tell.
Yes, no,
not
I mean,
to diminish, not to diminish Dan's movie. I thought it was really good.
Yeah,
but you know, and a lot had happened since then.
Oh, sure. And what I personally thought is nice is that it came at his career from a different point of view. Yours came at his career from, you know, obviously it's retrospective in some sense because he's not making films anymore. It had a lot more of him, you know, personal reflection. I liked the fact that you had a lot of people that were close to him that actually do support him and did believe in him. And, you know, yes, like Michael Paré said, yeah, he might be offensive, you know, to some, but, you know, is he misunderstood? Yeah, maybe, you know. And
what I thought was neat when we were doing the film, when we originally started out, because of his reputation, we thought it was going to be easy to find people that had nothing but bad things to say about him,
right,
and kind of a bit more difficult to find the positive view.
Mm.
And, you know, immediately our first round of interviews, we discovered that it wasn't as black and white, and people didn't have that sort of position. We would talk to people that knew him really well, and they would say wonderful things about him, and they would say horrible things about him. Like, he's just a complex, two-sided guy. And then the more you interview people with that mindset, the more interesting the character becomes.
Hmm. It's very easy, I think, to when you're doing a documentary like this about someone who is as infamous as they are famous, to throw a lot of that, you know, I'm glad that you didn't have too much of all that terrible internet footage of these wankers on their soapboxes inside their mother's basements with their posters behind them, simply saying, you know, vitriol into the camera, which I think is completely unfounded. I personally think that a lot of these people judge Dua Bowl based on popular opinion, because most people, let's face it, are sheep when it comes to popular opinion, wouldn't you agree?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, as soon as the narrative became that he was the worst filmmaker in the world,
yeah,
it was easier to just agree with that than to ask, why is he the worst filmmaker? And is he going to always be the worst filmmaker? Like, his first three North American movies, House of the Dead, Blood Rain, and In the Name of the King, were not great movies.
Mm.
And Uwe will say it himself, that they were not great movies. But just because he made those three at the start of his career, it had completely tarnished him from there on out. And then it was easier to just say, oh, Uwe Boll's putting out a movie, it's going to be dog shit. Instead of, oh, maybe this one's good, and then watching it and rating it on its own merit.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's it always struck me as he had battles on every front. I felt so bad in a lot of ways every time there was press about him that he was fighting. He's fighting. You can't really call them critics. They're just, you know, I refuse to call a lot of people online who claim to be critics because they're not critics. They're just...
just because you have a webcam doesn't make you a film critic.
Exactly. Or a podcast, for that fact. I mean, there's, you know, I'm going to come out and throw some shit at some people here, but just because you have a forum does not make you an expert.
Exactly. Yeah.
And you know, there are plenty of other, like you said in your documentary, there are plenty other of terrible films that are made every year, and what we would consider to be hack filmmakers. You know, and some of them have made ridiculous sums of money, so they can't be too much of a hack, because they seem to be able to please the people that matter, and ultimately the people that matter in the film business are the people that have agreed to finance your film, and making a financially successful product is ultimately the name of the game. If the audience likes it as well, that's kind of a bonus, don't you think?
Yeah, and it depends on what you consider a good film.
Exactly.
Is a good film what brought in the most at the box office?
Mm.
Is a good film the one that has the most hard-hitting story? You know, do you rate a film, are you impressed by a film because an independent filmmaker made it and it hit a wide audience?
Mm.
Like, there's a bunch of different ways to look at what is a successful film.
Yes.
And I look at Uwe's career as, he might be one of the most successful producers ever.
Mm.
Maybe not the best director, but his producing skills are second to none. Like, how do you continue making film after film after film when you're getting horrible reviews? You're getting slagged on the internet nonstop.
Mm.
You know, one of those reviews would be a career ender for most filmmakers.
Oh, sure.
Uwe just lets it roll off his back and goes and makes another movie, and another movie, and another movie.
Yeah.
And it worked for him, because he did it for 20-plus years.
Yeah. And which leads us into the something which dispels the fact that he was a hack and a terrible filmmaker. He was a terrible filmmaker. A, he couldn't convince financiers to give him money, and B, he couldn't deliver a product that at least must have obviously been successful enough for them to finance another film, right? So there's a cycle.
Yeah.
There's a cycle of success there that people fail to acknowledge. Like you said, all they seem to acknowledge is the fact that he gets terrible reviews. Now that's only a very tiny piece of the tip of the iceberg. What your film reveals is that he is a very successful producer. He does know the job very well. He does understand the game a lot more than people think.
I would say more than most filmmakers do.
Sure.
Yeah. And I'm talking big Hollywood directors as well. Uwe understands the game, understands the formula of filmmaking.
Sure. And I think that is something that is constantly overlooked when people talk about him or discover him. They tend to just hear other people's voices and say, his films are shit. He's terrible. Like, why waste your time? All that sort of thing. But what they gloss over is the fact that he during his time, he was tremendously prolific and very successful. And if that had not have been the case, then he wouldn't have been able to be prolific. Like you said, he would have made the first film. It would have been a big pile of crap, made no money, got terrible reviews, and that would have been the last we would have heard of him. But that's not the case. That's
yeah, Hollywood is littered with stories like that. People that had one shot, and then they made a shit movie, and they crawled back under their rock or went and worked at a car wash or whatever.
Yeah, and a lot...
But kept plugging away.
Exactly, and a lot more critically and commercially lauded filmmakers have been in that position. You know, just off the top of my head, I often think of Richard Kelly, who did wonderful things for people when he made Donnie Darko. They gave him a blank check to go away and do whatever he wanted next. He went away and did Southland Tales, which I still maintain is a wonderful film. But as far as a commercial success...
that makes one of us.
Yeah. As far as a commercial success, it was not what they wanted. And so he really went into the woods. I know he made another film after that, and wrote a few scripts, but he really hasn't been seen since. Now there's a filmmaker.
Yeah.
There's a filmmaker, if you want to put them on the scale, had a lot better, was more critically and commercially loved than Uwe Boll was, but you know, one of them kept making movies and one didn't. So.
Yeah, exactly. You know. And if Uwe's career was reversed, and he had made his later films early in his career,
yeah,
because his later films are good films.
Yes.
They're I'm not counting some of the sequels and you know, the extended sequels are not great.
Right.
But he made some really good political films later on in his career that meant a lot to him.
Mm.
And if he started his career with those, you know, we'd be having a much different conversation right now.
Oh, sure.
It's because he made these horrible films off the start that he spent his entire career trying to crawl out of that hole.
Yeah. Well, in his conversation with me, the brief conversation we had, I asked him, you know, these video game properties, because, I mean, he was attacking it from the point of view of, well, if I want to be successful... I need commercial property, something that is commercial, something that's going to sell, right? And so he went after these video game properties, and I said, are these games that you played? Are these games that you liked? And he said, nobody wanted them. You know, nobody wanted them. So he snatched them up, and, you know, and the way he saw it is like, well, this is something commercial, just like, In the as you might call it, the Hollywood leagues, you know, whenever there's a bestseller or a best-selling graphic novel, or, you know, something that already has a built-in audience, that's what they go for. That's what they'll license. So he was only doing, you know, I guess what he thought was the commercially smart thing, and getting a lot of commercial IPs together. To say, well, look, I have, you know, and I mean, it must have been very attractive for financiers at the time, saying, well, look, I've got this game, it's got a built-in audience, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, I mean, let's face it, we are living now in a time, as I've heard it often called by other people that I've interviewed, is potentially the safest period in Hollywood's history, because they're not gambling on anything new. They're solely making films that are either based on comic books or pre-existing, you know, commercially successful IPs and all that sort of thing. So we're
absolutely in, yeah. And if Uwe's first North American film, which was House of the Dead, if that wasn't a commercial property and he just made his own movie about zombies on an island,
yes.
And he was a German director that came over to North America and just made a Zombies on an Island movie.
Yeah.
That would have been it. He would have made one movie, and that was it.
Exactly.
But the fact that it was House of the Dead and it had a built-in audience, even if people didn't like it, people went and saw it.
Yes.
And that led to the next one, and led to the next one.
Mm.
And if you look back, nobody has made a good video game movie.
No.
They just... It's an impossible task to take a video game property and turn it into a 2-hour consumable movie.
Yeah, they're always, you know, they're always, I'm not going to say interesting, but they're always, it's amazing sometimes where what they come up with to fill, you know, 90 minutes. Like, personally, I think it's tough to beat, like, Super Mario Brothers. Like, how they got all that out of, you know, anyone who ever played Super Mario Brothers thinks, and sat down, you know, the plot, what would the plot of a Super Mario Brothers film be? That's still, for my money, the most ambitious. Like, wow, they got this whole, you know, alternate dimension and, you know, Dennis Hopper, and, you know, that's pretty impressive. But
yeah, and I mean, if you look at the reach of the Super Mario Brothers franchise, it's huge worldwide.
Sure.
That movie was a giant budget movie, had big stars in it, and it's fucking terrible.
Yeah.
so that easily could have been another Google video game movie that just didn't work.
Yeah.
And then he would get blamed as the worst director ever, and I can't believe he destroyed this franchise. But it's tough to make video game movies.
Yeah, but you know, you got to give them their due for giving it a go. Personally, I think the most touching and certainly the most telling line in your film comes from Brendan Fletcher, who says he says it of critics, but really it could be said of anyone who criticizes anyone that puts themselves out there. He says that how much have they risked? Have they risked all? I'm paraphrasing, but he talks about risking all, and how much have they risked?
That really struck a chord with me too as an independent filmmaker. Like Uba and I found a lot of similarities between us.
Right.
Because, you know, no one's telling me yes or no to make a movie. I just have to go out and do it myself.
Right.
And there is a, you know, you are putting yourself on the line. And there's nobody to fall back on and blame for when it doesn't go well. That definitely rings true that it's so much easier to sit behind a computer and say what didn't work about your movie. But to go out there and do it yourself is quite the task. And I can't remember if it's in the film or not, but I remember Clint Howard saying to me during the interview that you'll never find a filmmaker that's going to criticize Uwe. Maybe with the exception of Michael Bay, but that might have been some baiting.
Yeah.
But, you know, anyone who's been through the process and has done it on any level, independent or, you know, a $200 million movie, it's not easy. It's very difficult to do. Much more difficult to make a really good film.
Yeah.
There's, you know, how many great films come out a year? 5, maybe?
Yeah. Not many.
So it's tough to be one of those.
Yeah, not many. You know, there's a lot of great spectacles, but the difference between a spectacle and a good movie, I think, is quite a distance. Because
when you have unlimited money and an unlimited visual effects team,
right? Yeah.
And a built-in audience like every movie that comes out now.
Yeah.
It's a lot easier to make a successful movie.
I think that the mainstream audience have been sanitized and sensitized enough to just simply accept whatever new blockbuster comes out that really has the depth of a pygmy's wading pool, you know. But that
it's
makes
true. It, I mean, if there was a, that if makes, there was a large push from the media and saying that a Uwe Boll movie was great.
Yes.
The critics would all jump on board saying it was great. All the fans would jump on board saying it was great. It's kind of a whatever people are told, they believe. They were told early on that Uwe Boll is the worst filmmaker ever.
Yes.
And then it's hard to shake that.
And just like Lindsay Hollister says, she's got a great line. She says he would need to come out and make a film, but possibly under an assumed name, because his name, you know, has so much baggage attached to it. It would be interesting if he came out and made a film under a different name and it turned out to be successful, and then they find out that filmmaker is actually Uwe Boll.
Yeah, exactly. And I actually brought that up to him.
Yeah.
And he said in this day and age, there's no way, because someone on set would tweet about it or someone on set would take a picture of him. Yeah. Then it's, Uwe Boll's so bad that he has to hide under this persona,
right,
and it would tarnish his image even more.
Yeah.
So I kind of give him kudos for owning it and putting his name on it and being, that is an Uwe Boll film. If you don't like it, go fuck yourself.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. But, look, mate, you've made a tremendous film, wonderful portrait. I'm an Uwe Boll fan, so I was very excited to watch the film and to talk to you. I sincerely hope it does really well. Where are people eventually going to be able to experience Fuck You All?
Well, we premiere it at the end of the month. That's November 2018. We premiered up at the Whistler Film Fest, and we've got a European sales agent that's kind of dealing with our worldwide sales, and you know, we're trying to find the right avenue for it. We've got a few offers, but we need to make sure it's the right avenue because we want people to see it. We don't want it to just disappear.
Right.
So, I can't give you a straight answer on that yet.
Right.
But hopefully,
eventually it'll be streaming and DVD, Blu-ray, all that sort of thing, eventually.
We definitely want to get as many eyes on it as possible.
Right. So, but for right now, the film festival circuit's the best place to try and track it down.
Yeah, we've got a few festivals coming up, and it's being taken to film markets and shopped around, and I have no doubt that it'll be out there, available for people to see soon. I just don't have the exact answer for you yet.
That's okay. Fuck You All. I mean that in the nicest possible way. We'll be out there at some point. It's a wonderful new film, The Portrait, by Sean Patrick Scholl, of the wonderfully, sadly, given the game away. You love him, you hate him. I love him. He's Uwe Boll. It's a wonderful film, mate. Wonderful. I was very at once.
Thank you.
I was once at once informed, moved, excited. A little bit regretful, but I mean, as he says, the man himself says that everything has changed, and the way that he was able to get his films financed, it's all changed now. So yeah, everything moves on, but for the time that he worked, certainly he would do very well, I think, teaching a course in film production and how to raise money and all that sort of thing, maybe, you know, because he's,
absolutely, and I think he'll be looked back, 20 years from now. I think people will look back at him as an important filmmaker, whether they like his films or not.
Sure.
He really broke the mold.
Yeah, he really is a great testament to being independent. And making everything your own and not relying on the system as it stands.
He's a great example of someone who really loved film and wanted to make films, and then just went and did it. Didn't ask for permission to do it. Didn't wait for someone to hand him a bag of money. He loved films, wanted to make films, so he went out and did it. It's pretty impressive.
It is. Fuck You All.
Fun to say, right?
It is. It's liberating, but it also has a purpose because it's the title of the documentary. Fuck You All. Oh, goodness. I would love to introduce it on stage. And now, Sean Patrick Shaw's Fuck You All. It's going to be great when you win awards. I wonder if they're going to, like on IMDb at the moment, they have the F, just the F and the K and a few little dots in between. I wonder if they're going to actually put the whole title if you win like a trophy or something on the trophy.
Well, when I entered it on IMDb, it was the full title and they decided to change it on.
I guess
that's the title they're going with.
Yeah. Because people go to type it
it's in. The full uncensored version to me.
Fuck You All, uncut.
Yeah, I mean, if you see that title and you see the asterisk and think that there isn't going to be swearing in that film, then, you know, you've got another thing coming.
Yeah. Yeah. It's great. And it's a great title. It sums it up. It sums it up perfectly. And it's been really wonderful, Sean, to talk with you, mate. Like I said, I hope every success comes your way. It's a wonderful movie.
Great. Thanks for having me on.
What does Dr. Boll think of it? Has he seen the movie?
He really liked it.
You liked it? You got the thumbs up?
Yeah, he had, he's honest to a fault. So yeah. There was little bits and pieces that irked him this way and that way. But, as a whole, he liked the film a lot. And, we had our private cast and crew screening at his bar, and
That's great.
It was a great night, and he came up and said a few words first, and yeah, he likes the film.
Oh, that's great. That's good.
Which was important to us.
Well, yeah, naturally. I mean, it mightn't see the light of day if the subject hated it. you know, becomes the Citizen Kane of our time. But, yeah. I mean, I personally would love to see that, actually. Like, you know, I was thinking about that after watching it. Like, what if they'd make a fictional biographical film of Uwe Boll, and who would play Uwe Boll? And, yeah.
Oh, God, I'd love to see that.
Yeah. I mean, it would, yeah. Yeah. It boggles the mind. But that's for a different episode. Thank you, Sean, for being on Podcast Them Softly. Everyone listening, check it out when you get the opportunity. Fuck you all. I'm sorry I keep saying that, but that's the title of the film. Check it out. It's the Uwe Boll story. My guest has been Sean Shawl. Have I been pronouncing your last name right? Shawl?
Yeah, you got it.
Thank goodness.
You got it. Well, thanks for having me. It was a pleasure. And,
tremendous, mate.
Can't wait to get the film to Down Under.
Yep, wonderful.